Good morning, or good day for people anywhere in the world. My name is Dalia Varanka, and Dr. Mark Schildhauer and I are the organizers for this fourth session of the Earth Science Ontologue mini-series of ontology dialogues. Slide number two, please. The objectives of the series of presentations, there were three prior to ours and will be one yet to come, had the objectives of exploring the current status and application of multi-level ontologies relevant to the earth sciences. The reason why a broader objective for these ontologies would be to envision a semantically enabled cyber infrastructure for doing science in what some people call the big data age. And by holding these series, we hope to engage in a dialogue of ontology and semantics between ontologists and earth science researchers and practitioners. Next slide, slide number three. Our panelists, the briefings on today's agenda, begin with Dr. Luis Bermudez, representing the Open Geospatial Consortium, followed by Dr. Boyan Broderick from the Geological Survey of Canada. I won't read their titles. They will. You'll get more out of it if you tie that to the content when they come on. We have Dr. Norman Morrison from the University of Manchester in UK, and Mr. Thomas Kwong from the JPL NASA Research Center. And Dr. Mark Schildhauer will present together with Mr. Ben Adams on a joint project, and Mark will be offering a few words in conclusion to the session, followed by an open question and answer session and discussion among the panelists and all participants. We will not be taking questions at the end of presentations. The presentations will move one to the next, but remember your questions, jot them down on the chat page. And if you are on the chat page, you will see that at the bottom on the right-hand side, the little icon with the open hand, and we will take questions in order. On the next slide, slide number four, I just thought I'd speak a little bit about what was meant by our title, a review of earth science, of available earth science ontologies. Review is a simple word for a complex topic. One thing this session will not do is present a comprehensive inventory of all of the ontologies that are available for earth science. What we did aim to do was to bring together some important projects that are representative of the field. There is a wide variety of thematic content and representational structures, as well as different insights into the processes of doing earth science research and practice, particularly with important elements and facets such as the population data of the database and the maintenance, interoperability between data sets and ontologies, and governance of these systems. However, it's also important to remember that information is not entirely prescriptive. And though we tend to be the designers of an ontological system, data and information acquire meaning as they are used in practice. And this is evident in ontology as tools are revised with use and time. And we will be getting updates on how ontologies have changed, perhaps some that we have already seen, and outlooks for the future. So with that, I would just like to invite our first speaker, Dr. Luis Bermudez, to begin, and let's get started.
So, Mark, Peter, Dalia, thank you very much for this invitation. So I'm in slide number one. So when I got the request to do this presentation, I thought that presenting what we're doing at the OGC Open Geospatial Consortium will be important. The reason is, when I first started interacting with the OGC, this was about 8 years ago when we were doing sensor integration data, there was one piece missing, and it was the semantics piece. How do we properly identify properties, units of measure, processes, and so forth? And OGC at that point had no interest at all in providing identifiers or thinking about ontologies or how to better capture identification of resources and so forth. a lot of things have changed since then. So I want in this presentation to present, and this is slide number two, first, some clarifications about OGC, Open Geospatial Special Consortium, for those of you that are not familiar with it, since this is, I think, more a science and technical domain group, and some of you may not be aware of OGC. Second, what we mean about ontologies and what I'm going to refer to in the context of this presentation. Why do we need URIs at OGC? How do we manage those URIs, which is a big issue in some communities, the governance part. Some examples of what we're doing with GeoSparkQL, which is a new standard at OGC, and then some cool activities, experiments that we have done in the past 2 years. Next slide. No, OGC. So we are a non-profit standards organization, as similar to others. For example, W3C is another example. We have about 475 volunteer organizations as of yesterday, and 4,300 users that are in the portal that participate in the working groups and that do all the work. What is the final produce of OGC is standards that people like to share because they're open and because it brings confidence that it is being supported by an open process that a lot of communities have agreed on. Next slide. And the most important part of OGC is the interaction that we create among the people. We OGC staff, what we do is coordinate a lot of incredible brain power to bring the standards and try to make them workable, to provide workable solutions for today's geospatial issues. Slide number five. So we hold 4 meetings per year anywhere around the world. The last meeting was in Seoul. The next meeting will be in California. So I invite all of you that are interested in participating in these meetings to join. Slide number six. So how is this related to earth sciences? Well, that's a very good question. If you go to slide number seven, you will see a slide that says geoscience and remote sensing. There was an article published in this IEEE newsletter. A lot of good examples about how geosciences in sort of way depends on geospatial information standards. Slide number eight, and these are some examples. There are plenty of sessions that talk about how open standards help in geosciences. There are committees on Earth Observation Standards Working Group. There are some particular projects such as DIGES that helps to coordinate the different projects in Europe, such as GEOS Inspire, and about how to better improve the research and monitor the environment. This is not only for Earth data, but also for models to express, for example, quality of phenomena like air quality. So it's also products that needs to be that require some kind of processing and so forth. Slide number nine. So, some data in science is survey OGC standards. I start with that premise, and then that's how I relate what we do here at OGC and science. Some of those standards, for example, you may be familiar with those are NetCDF, KML, for maps, WMS is a standard interface to get maps, Sensor Observation Services, SOS, to get standards, WPS, Web Processing Services, to invoke processes on the web, and the first one, NetCDF, is a format that is being used in particular for gridded data. Slide number 10. So at the end, what we want is to try to put the data together, data from different sources. The best example for science is when I'm going to run a model, I want to compare it to Earth, to real-time data, for example, sensors, put those together, and then improve my model based on the latest data, or if I want to deploy an asset such as, for example, an autonomous underwater vehicle, I want to know what's the best way I can deploy it based on some short forecast. So these are two examples of how real-time data that you need access, standard access to those data in order to provide support for science. Slide number 11. So there are some issues with the data that is available. I think we are already at some point where we have some part of the infrastructure that requires to do that, in particular getting access to one server and download the data. But there are still some semantic issues, as some of you are aware, where we can call different concepts different ways. When we have different representations, we have different models that make sometimes the task of bringing the data together a little bit complex. slide number 12. So even if you say SST, you can even go to different domains, and this can start getting very complicated. Slide number 13. This also occurs in when you have the metadata elements, not only in the values. So when you want to capture the, for example, variable or property, sometimes you can call it in different way. So we have semantic issues in a lot of different levels. Now, slide number 14, and this is ontologies, and so this is the classical definition. Gruber defines the specification of conceptualization. My assumptions here is that, well, if we identify at least a class and a resource and make a URI for that, we're making a very minor specification of at least one concept, and that I will call an ontology. I will try to keep it very simple. Some of the ontologies that I'm going to present have very few properties, have very few classes, but it can serve as a starting point. So we create class and properties that fit our needs. And we are not here in the business to create upper formal ontologies. For example, we are not going to discuss endurance or perendurance within OGC. I leave that for other more experts in computer science or philosophy. Slide number 15. So why do we need URIs, and why do we need sort of identifiers and resources and URLs within OGC? Well, we produce hundreds of artifacts per year at OGC. We produce standards, we produce specifications, reference models, schemas, engineering reports, policies, best practices, white papers, change requests. For example, slide number 16, only in 2011 there were 64 change requests that were submitted. Slide number 17, that the best way to proceed, we need a proper way to identify all these resources in the web. The best way to do that is to do it formally and to register in IANA, a URN namespace. So OGC did that. So there is an IANA URN for OGC. Slide number 18. So this is the RFC 5165. In slide 18, where it talks about the URN OGC namespace and the syntax, and also points to two different things. One is for our resolver, that is http://urnopengis.net, and also talks about an OGC naming authority. These are two key components. Why? Because some of the resources are going to be URN, which, as you know, they are not easy to locate. And the other one is we need a governance. Even within OGC, we're required to do that internally. Recently, slide number 19, in June 2010, OGC said, well, if we have two choices, URNs, or let's say HTTPs, and URNs, it is preferred to go HTTP URIs. I think this was a good way to move forward, also a smart way to align better with what's going to to come with linked data and so forth. So slide number 20, we need to identify more than documents and artifacts, and I will show some of those things. Slide number 21. So if you can see, we have, we need identifiers, and we have already identifiers for definition types. This includes coordinates, axes, axis directions, coordinate operations, coordinate systems, data types. Slide number 22. We have also a way to identify unique parts within a document. So we know that a document, an OGC document in particular, an OGC specification or OGC standard, has classes, figures, tables, terms, and definitions. All those have URIs. So we have a URI that says this is a conformance class, but we also have a URI for every conformance class that we can then link from the executable test. Slide number 23, for example, if there is a specification that talks about coverages, then the specification can provide very specific URIs that are needed for coverage, to share coverages, for example, in this case. And I don't know why this is repeated, but it provides types of coverages like monopass, multipass, single swath. Slide number 24. Then one of the things that I was talking about was the vocabulary server. And we have one. This is provided by CICERO. So all the vocabularies are formalized in RDF ESCOS. There is an endpoint SparkQL where developers can use to extract the information and to access it. There is a simple interface and also a way to search by labels, and these vocabularies are strongly governed. In the case of OGC, I said there is a naming authority in order to do that. One important thing is that in this vocabulary server, the owner is not always the case that is the same content of the URIs. So the vocabulary server provides, for example, URIs for concepts that are managed by another organization. For example, in the case OGC creates URIs for coordinate reference systems that sometimes are managed by EPSG. It's Petroleum Survey, I don't remember the exact name. Number 25. So the vocabulary server is called SysVoc, and this is another example of, well, if you have definitions in a specification such as WaterML, then you can see that those concepts such as mediums or also have a URI that identifies some mediums and are available at the OGC definition server because they are part of the specification. Slide number 25. So the OGC naming authority is a subcommittee of the technical committee, right? The technical committee is a subgroup of all the OGC members, those that have voting rights. So they approve every standard, they approve every test, they approve best practices, they create subcommittees, they create the working groups. So OGC naming authority is a subcommittee of this technical committee. They manage all the registry resources. They coordinate with OGC staff about how do we make the publication of these URIs, in which server, how do we do it. And then every standard that is going to be submitted for publication passes through the OGC naming authority. So though the URIs that are inside an OGC specification are all checked. Slide number 27. So I'm going to provide conclusions or this first part of some science that is published via OGC standards, right? I think that that's very important. OGC standards now are full of URIs, and that we use those to identify resources and also particular elements inside the standards, and are all governed and maintained by the OGC naming authority. Okay, so that's part of the talk. Now I'm going to talk briefly about other two things. One is OGC GeoSparkQL. So GeoSparkQL is a new standard, was approved in April, was published in September. This, in this slide, is information about how to access the document, who were the main editors, slide number 29. And I'm going to just briefly talk about it. So it defines some basic concepts and like geospatial object, and it provides a class called GeoFuture and GeoGeometry, and a property, a Geo has geometry. And it is expected that then the communities provide subclasses based on these very special root classes. Slide number 30, this is an example of, well, if you have a GeoFuture, then you can create a point of interest, a monument, and then create an instance called Washington Monument that you can link with another instance that is a special point, that is an instance of GeoPoint, that is a subclass of GeoGeometry. Slide number 31, the GeoSparky also provides very special geospatial properties that are important to, for example, query, such as contains, covered by, covers, disjoint, equals, crosses, and so forth, based on Eggenhofer and others. So you can take a look at that if you're interested. 32, there is an excellent resource article that talks about, well, how you can use GeoSparkQL for the semantic web. And then I'm going to go to slide number 33. So OGC has an interoperability program, right? We have four programs. One of those is the IP program, where we really test the standards, we advance the standards to see what it works, what it doesn't, and it's really a fast proof of concept activity. We have about, in the last one, about 8 sponsors, about 50 participants from all over around the world. Slide number 34. In the last year activity, we had a motivation scenario where we have two models, the NGA model and the USGS model, that are all based on GML. And what we wanted to see is if we had a user that is familiar with the USGS model, can we provide a capability that is able to query two models and then provide back the information in one model, which requires two, the semantic mediation, because we want to convert all the different elements from one model to another. This is how do we convert, and I'm going to talk now in GML language. So how do we create like a GML future and the attributes and properties of those futures to another GML model? How do we then provide the styles that one model uses to another model? Slide number 35. So this was the architecture. We have a client that was accessing in the right side on Iberim. This is a portrayal styles where you see, well, you have all the icons that links to a particular feature type. Then we have a registry that's the composable CSW Iberim registry. And we had a semantic mediation component that provided a wrapper. This is a W web feature service on top of USGS. So there was an NGA semantic mediation model, or semantic mediator that was able to get USGS data and present it as NGA, and the other way around. So then the client was able to interact with that semantic mediation model. The semantic mediation model accessed the SparkQL server to get the rules and get the mappings of the different properties and features. In OWS9, this is slide number 36, we also were requested by some of the sponsors. This is an aviation sponsor that said, well, I have a glossary, glossary for pilots, and I want to use the terms in that glossary to be able to access, again, a web future service, a WFS, that uses a particular application profile from GML called AXIM, AXM. So slide number 37 shows sort of how AXIM looks like. For example, it's Trax, it's a very special GML where they create their own particular features. For example, an elevated point, this is very important for aviation, that provides more specifics about, you know, a point, like the vertical accuracy. Slide number 38, this is more about XM features. So let's go to slide number 39. So what we want to do is a pilot, uses the pilot controller glossary to be able to access WFS features, right? This is really, you know, polygons, by only using the glossary terms. So the client interacted with this SparkQL server and was able then to access the WFS endpoints. So line number 40 shows the client that is, for example, a user is tapping high-speed taxiway and then is able to find taxiway element from the WFS. Slide number 41. There is another work that has been advanced in OWS 9, and this is GeoNames. We have a different GASI tiers, so we have Genies, Genes, you know, Alexandria Data Library, and so forth. So what we want to do is to be able to do mappings across these GASI tiers and be able to get all the features that are related. For example, in Genies, mountains and hills are called summit. In GNS are called mountains and hills. So how do we find, for example, the best place to land or a mountain near Rincon if we don't have any semantic mediation and to put these data together? So we have created mappings across these different GASI tiers, put those mappings in a SparkQL server, and then allow a WFS semantic mediator to access those mappings and provide the information. This is also cascading WFS search service to the client. Slide number 42. So this is just to say thank you. This is my contact information and also a related blog that I wrote, I think, about a month ago, about some of the details I discussed here about how OGC is playing with linked data. Thank you.
Thank you, Luis. Our next speaker is Boyan Broderick. Boyan, go ahead.
So this presentation in the next 15 minutes is really looking at how aspects of formal ontology can help us develop a ontology representation for water, particularly for integrating elements of the surface and subsurface water domains. It's being conducted in collaboration with Michael Gruninger's group at the University of Toronto, and most of this work has been done in collaboration with Torsten Hammann, who is a soon-to-be PhD graduate from that program. And I should add that it's fairly new work and still in progress, and so this is more a report on where we're at right now. Next slide, please, slide number 2. The driver for a lot of this work is the recognition that countries and country collaborations such as the EU are more and more requiring water accounting that includes both the surface and the subsurface. And so there's regulatory frameworks being set up where this type of accounting has to happen at various levels, at watershed levels, at larger regions, at national and at international regions. Some of the key elements here are things like the surface water basin, which represents the reporting area for the surface, or a groundwater body, which represents often reporting area for the subsurface. In order to be able to provide a holistic report, it's obviously necessary to connect these two together. Next slide, number 3. In order to achieve that, because of some of the areas that are being looked at, there's a need to combine multiple data sources to provide all the information required for this type of accounting. And so a lot of organizations that have to deal with this data, primarily at the government level, including my own, are looking at spatial data infrastructure technologies to help in that. And that is connect spatial data from multiple sources to be able to feed into decision support and accounting reporting frameworks. And these are ongoing right now in Australia, in Europe, in the US, and to some degree also in Canada. So we both have these accounting frameworks for reporting on water being established, but also technologies necessary to be able to bring them together. The issue, of course, is that there are competing ways for these emerging technologies in terms of the description of the various elements. And so what we have are sometimes heterogeneities in the concepts sitting behind the data formats that are trying to serve this data. And there's a variety of data formats now being established within the both the OGC community that Lewis just discussed and elsewhere related that are starting to be also made legal requirements for providing the data to the accounting frameworks. And these are sometimes we've got similar terms here that are ambiguous, and so it's unclear often how these could be combined, particularly for surface and subsurface, to work together. So an example of some of the issues, next slide please, number four, is the issue of, for instance, in the subsurface, the definition of a groundwater body. It's sometimes unclear within the various frameworks whether this is referring to a particular amount of matter or to an object that composed the matter. So for an example of this, you might want to think of a particular aquifer and refer to the water body of that aquifer, which might be fixed. But then you might also refer to the matter itself, which is the water that can actually change as the water flows through the aquifer. Analogously, you can think of, for instance, bloodstream. Bloodstream tends to be a fixed concept, but of course our blood changes, the matter within it changes. So there's this issue of, you know, is it an object or is it the matter within the object? And this is very important because, for instance, for water quality issues, it's very important to talk about the matter itself, which would contain contaminants and which flow from one area to the other. And in terms of water quantity, it's also important because the matter might disappear, whereas we might still talk about the water body within some dry river that just doesn't happen to be there. The matter itself may not be present. So this distinction becomes rather important, and it's not always clear which one is being referred to. The other distinction that tends to be important, both for quantity and quality for water, is the notion of spaces or voids in which the water sits. Because this actually controls a lot of the science to do with where water flows and how it flows. And then if we look at the emerging standards that are coming out on these issues, there's some ambiguities and differences between them that really, you know, challenge the ability to be able to deliver information in standard ways so that we're actually, so that the data is referring to the same concepts. For instance, it's unclear whether we're talking about objects or matter in terms of the water bodies under the Inspire context. And in some cases, the notion of spaces and water flowing through them isn't considered. So the idea here is that there is to be able to use reference concepts to help disambiguate some of these problems and therefore be able to guide both standard design and ontology construction. Development ontology that would have these disambiguated, so it might help guide some of these standards or at least help guide the translation from and to these standards so that that's clear. Next slide, number five. In terms of types of reference ontologies, I'm borrowing a structure here published by Nicola Guarino in 98, where he talks about foundational domain and task application ontologies, and would like to recast them a little bit more in terms of science knowledge, in the sense that foundational ontologies might refer to cross-domain knowledge, so not particularly to within a particular scientific domain, whereas domain knowledge within this framework, I'd like to think about it as normative knowledge within a domain. So that type of knowledge that has been accepted within the scientific community and is seen to be fixed for the time being. And then more contextual knowledge where uses of that normative knowledge might change from one contextual situation to another. So we've got a gradient here in terms of contextuality. So for examples, we can look on the left here for the notion of matter, for instance, which might be constituting an object. So the water matter that might constitute a water body. Or in this case, the granite that might constitute a rock body. So granite has a fixed mineralogical composition defined scientifically, but it can have varying size of grains and it might have cracks. The way that one uses granite in particular applications, though, can vary tremendously. So we can use granite for a countertop, for instance, in which you talk about larger crystals and things that that can be porous, particularly. But it's still the same mineralogical composition. So there's a degree of normativeness here, even with a wide variety of application. And similar for water bodies, we can talk about the fact that you know, generically, they're constituted by water and they can be connected and have human uses. And in particular applications, such as in particular country definitions or particular schemas, as described very nicely by Dutz and Janowitz, for instance, you know, Spanish rivers can be dry, may not connect, and may not be navigable, whereas German rivers can be connected and can be navigable. So there's quite differences in how the rivers are perceived there, and yet they still share all the essential qualities of water bodies in general. So for the purposes of this work, we're really looking at trying to understand what the essential or domain-specific normative aspects are of water that can be then used to help explain some of the more situational or contextual elements, such as the different elements of the notion of groundwater body, for instance, that I described earlier. And to some degree, help using foundational ontologies to help do that. Next slide, number 6. There are there's a fair bit of ontology work being done in the water sciences, particularly for aspects of it, such as properties, events, and processes, subsurface hydrogeology, etc. A lot of this isn't being done, though, from the focus of looking at its essential properties. It tends to be happening more at the bottom end of the three-tier structure that I just discussed. So where this work is a little bit different from much, although not quite all of this, is looking at more the first two levels rather than the third level. As you can see from the slide, there are a few exceptions there, but as a general statement, I think that's fair. Next slide, number 7. So one way to get at this problem of what some of these essential concepts might be, particularly to help link the surface and subsurface domains, is to look at where they differ. So, for instance, in the surface water, water is contained within ground depressions, whereas in the subsurface, it's contained within actual grains between particles underground. So there's different containers if you want to see it. In terms of boundary concepts, which would bridge the subsurface and surface domains, there we look at things like flow or processes. So there's the notion of base flow, for instance, which talks about the flow of water from the surface to the subsurface. So that definitely acts as a bridging concept. And then there's common concepts, things that both domains might share. And that's particularly where our interest is here. So we're looking at using the notion of a container schema to apply or to be as a general abstraction for many of the things in the surface and subsurface and use that as a mechanism to help try and link them ontologically. So that's what the next set of slides is briefly going to get into. So next slide, number 8. So the container schema, is intuitively relatively simple in the sense that water flows into a space which is created by some container which is composed of some matter. And that water itself, the mass of it consists of a body and some materials, water and other foreign substances that compose that body, which fills the void, which is contained by a container. So that's the abstract view of it. The premise here is that by distinguishing these simple concepts, we can actually make some headway into disambiguation at the middle tier level for some of the issues that we encountered earlier. So next slide, number 9. The way this helps us link ontologically the surface water and subsurface water domains is represented in this slide. So we've got similar notions of water flow for the time being, but you'll notice that the notion of containers and water bodies and water matter may differ slightly. So a container object, for instance, in the surface is a ground depression, essentially, composed of the materials that are create or are part of the Earth or planetary body at that location. The spaces that the water body would sit inside is the actual cavity in the surface created by that depression, whereas in the subsurface, it's actually the spaces between the grains. I did forget to mention that the container for the subsurface is actually the particular grains of material where the water sits in between those grains. So, and the water bodies in both cases are held within the container, but of course in the surface it tends to be a homogeneous mass, where in the subsurface the object itself might potentially be disconnected if the spaces between the particles aren't connected themselves. So we've got this sense that this container schema actually applies to both the surface and the subsurface. with variation, of course, in terms of the implementation within both. Next slide, number 10. So our approach then was to try and keep these distinctions somehow within an ontological framework, and the way that we went about this was to map those concepts onto the Dolce foundational ontology, which has already some headings that would allow us to make these distinctions. So, for instance, the notion of flow is part of the process and perduant stream in Dolce. The matter and objects which act as containers is separated in Dolce through amount of matter and physical object. But there's also the notion that we have features such as a surface depression, so a shallow in the ground, can also act, in this case, as a container. And then the notion of voids or spaces are also types of features that can be modeled in Dolce as dependent entities on a particular container. So there's a starting point in which to place these things within Dolce, and the various concepts that we discussed earlier can then be organized underneath them. One of the gaps that we recognized fairly quickly as we were going down this road was the notion of void. So the spaces in which the water bodies would sit has been fairly well developed for surface water in terms of logical formal theory, but not as well developed for what would be necessary for the subsurface. So then before continuing on fleshing out this type of scheme, we've spent some time looking at voids. Next slide, number 11. So the seminal work on spaces or voids was carried out by Cassati and Farsi, and they essentially classified holes in objects, which works quite well into three categories: depressions, cavities, and tunnels. And this works quite well for the surface, where particularly for depression or hollow, which would be, for instance, where a lake or a river would sit inside or constitute part thereof. But it doesn't really work for the subsurface, where we're really looking at gaps between particles. So if we look at the next slide, number 12.
5 more minutes, please.
Okay. The next slide, number 12, talks about extensions that we've done so that we can help model subsurface spaces. And this was done recently with Torsten, where we're looking at different types of gaps. And so that we can elegantly model where water would sit in gaps in the subsurface between particles. Next slide, number 13. And what this allows us to do is then generalize the notion of what a void is from a hole or a gap, holes being the previous work that was done, under features, and provides us with a broad coverage of the types of holes required to hold water within containers. What's being worked on now, then, are some relations so that we can more accurately talk about what it means to be inside a hole. A lot of spatial relations currently are largely geared to being between, so the domain and range of them are largely between entities that might contain a hole, but the entity itself isn't one. And for purposes of being able to more accurately speak about something existing within a particular hole, we need to make some adjustments to those containment relations. And this is particularly important for subsurface things, for instance, like oil and so on, where the container might have a fairly large space, but it's actually part of that space that is only fillable with oil or water or gas, etc. So it is important to be able to distinguish the notion of a hole from the container to be able to properly and accurately model those parts of the domain. Next slide, number 14. So where we end up with at the moment is this type of three-tier situation where we've taken some of the general concepts that tend to be a bit more normative in the middle level there and can use them to help disambiguate some of the concepts that we started off with. So based on this disambiguation, it might be that the groundwater body from one standard is more oriented to being the matter, whereas for the other one, it tends to be more the water body. In the notion of features, by separating out the idea of the container from the object and the matter within it, it allows us then to say something like the notion that a river is a ground depression that may be filled by an object that contains a certain water matter. And it allows the quantifier to be placed on the actual object so that it can may or may not be there, for instance, so that we can then distinguish between dry and wet rivers or dry and wet lakes. Next slide. Before we go to the next slide. So this, it seems from this that these types of nuances are fairly useful in disambiguating some of the core concepts and might help, therefore, design of some of the standards activities, but also might help disambiguate the data when it needs to be translated back and forth. But we haven't tested that yet, but that's in the works. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that there's been some good progress made on some of the core concepts to help integrate the surface and subsurface by identifying five or six common entities between them that can be used as a basis for a deeper ontological representation. There is some work done on voids to allow us to deal with both the subsurface and the surface. And just to repeat from the previous slide, there's an opportunity here both to be able to disambiguate some conceptual differences in emerging standards, but also maybe to help with integration as we go. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'll close it there.
Thank you very much, Boyan. Very interesting talk. Our next speaker is Norman Morrison. Norman, please begin whenever you're ready.
Okay. I'm just going to start by thanking the co-chairs for inviting me to speak today. It's great to see an effort like this coming together and such a lot of related and interesting concepts being discussed. And also to Peter as well for his excellent logistical skills, because without them I would have definitely turned up an hour late after British summertime just ended here. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about ENVO, which is the environment ontology. Next slide, number two, please. So the ENVO is a community ontology for the concise controlled description of environment. The way ENVO came about actually was through a need. I should start off perhaps the presentation with a slight disclaimer in that originally I was a molecular biologist turned bioinformatician slash biodiversity informatician. And we actually came about developing ENVO because there was nothing else available for us to be able to do what we wanted to do, which was to be able to define and contextualize where biological samples were taken from. So what I mean by biological samples as well could be anything from a bucket of soil taken from a wetland, to a clinical sample, a tissue sample, right down to extraction of the DNA from that sample and then the molecular characterization of the cells therein. Next slide, slide number three. So the kinds of questions ENVO aims to address are who or what was there, what were they up to, and what was it like? I tend, when I'm giving some of these presentations, to take an Einstein quote, which was when Einstein was asked to describe what is an environment, he said that an environment is everything that is not me. So from our perspective, we're trying to describe environmental terms from a relative perspective. So we're trying to describe them from the perspective of that sample that is taken from the environment, such that it can be attached to a later date in a database or something like that, to metadata that has some kind of terminology that would then be understood biologists by biologists, or indeed ecologists, biodiversity informaticians, etc. Next slide, slide number four, please. And the reason for this is that ecologists etc., understand a lot more from a term such as boreal forest than they would do from a set of simple geographic coordinates. there's a lot of inherent or implicit information with a term such as boreal forest that just conjures up all sorts of system-level interactions about the kinds of species that are in that kind of environment and how they interact, what you would generally expect to find in an environment like that, and what kind of conditions, what kind of environmental parameters prevalent in those kind of environments. Next slide, slide number 5, please. So it was encouraging actually to see Boyen's presentation just beforehand, that the different levels of conceptualization of water and water features, because we actually independently sort of came up with a very similar kind of construct, where we've described three top level terms for the tree in the environment ontology, which are biome, environmental feature, and environmental material. I'm going to sort of illustrate some of these top level terms a little bit more by carrying on with some of the next slides. So next slide, number 6, please. We actually say marine, nerific, epipelagic biome. So at the biome level, what we're trying to describe is relative to the individual. In this case, we've got a killer whale in the picture. A system level descriptor or term that can encapsulate everything about that killer whale, were you to take it out of its void, and to use some of the terminology that Boyen was describing earlier. So if you were to describe a marine epipelagic biome, straight away an ecologist would have an understanding that you're talking about the top level of the marine zone that is gets light to it, so about the top sort of 50 to 200 meters. And then the nerific zone as well is that area between the shoreline and the continental shelf, so about extending down to about 200 meters. So this is one, when we are asking people to populate information about a sample within their database, this is one level that we ask people to contribute. Next slide, slide number 7, please. So the slide illustrates some information that we had to then capture about the feature level. So this is a bit like capturing information about the container. So here we would like to describe the marine tidal rocky reef relation to the next slide, slide number 8, please. Okay, so then, the third level, which is the material level, again, as Boyen was describing earlier, we have a similar kind of concept that if you were to take a sample from its environment, such as this particular killer whale, undoubtedly it would be difficult to take it straight out of its environment, but you would describe the void that the killer whale would leave, what actually surrounds it would be coastal water. So there we have a sort of a tripartite way for describing the environment of that particular sample. Next slide, number 9, please. So yeah, so then we have this was hopefully be the kind of metadata that we would see associated with a sample in a database that would make it more integratable, in our view, and more discoverable, so that if you were to take this particular sample, you would end up with something like marine nerific epipelagic biome, marine subtidal rocky reef, and coastal water, and taken together, these three sets of information would allow biologists to be able to find this kind of information related to this particular sample much more easily. And would provide a lot more extra information than just the geographic coordinates from where that sample came from. Next slide, please, slide number 10. There are, of course, numerous upper-level ontologies that one can align to. We've worked quite extensively with Barry Smith, and have from the word go, have been aligning ENVO to BFO and consequently have also been carrying out some more recent work aligning ENVO to BFO 2. I should point out that Pierre Luigi Buttigieg has been doing some remodeling of the upper level terms as well in collaboration with Barry. And we are more than likely to be releasing a newer version of ENVO within the next month or so that would incorporate some of this higher level remodeling of terms. Next slide, number 11, please. Typically, when we talk about perdurance and endurance, similarly, we can talk about independent and dependent continuance and occurrence with BFO, and this slide just illustrates, roughly speaking, where we expect to see the description of environments fitting. We describe environments from sort of a very small level, micro, right through to macro scales, because when we're trying to describe the relative environment to a particular organism or sample, and we might be describing a bacterial cell in a cavity on a human body, right up to a larger organism such as a polar bear on the Arctic ice sheet, but we still carry through the same kind of generic model of a whole, and that is filled by a particular material, no matter what level that we're working on. Next slide, number 12, please. If you want to find out more, there is now a more up to date website available, environmentontology.org. Next slide, number 13. This is just a link to the website, a screenshot of the website where you can see some of what we've been doing there. Next slide, number 14. I would encourage you to go there and participate in the project as well if you feel that there is something that you can contribute. We've had quite a number of contributors over the years. The project began in 2007 in collaboration with a number of people, including Michael Ashburner, who many of you will know was one of the instigators of the gene ontology, which is probably the most widely used ontology to date. You can browse ENVO using various tools on the website as well. We're part of BioPortal and OBE Foundry. Next slide, number 15, please. So governance and maintenance, we have an editorial team. The way we would see it working, leading to the future a bit more, is that we would have groups of people that have specialisms that can contribute to different branches of the ontology. So if you have a particular specialism that you would like to contribute to, then please get in touch. Next slide, number 17. As I said, it started back in 2007. We've had four official workshops that have been funded. It's developed by the Environmental Ontology Consortium. Next slide, number 18. We have now a number of users for a full list. You can see these on the website. It's actually because we developed ENVO in collaboration with the Genomic Standards Consortium. It is also recommended as a minimum information standard as part of the minimum information about any sequence specification, which is MIXES, which is published in Nature. And also the Advanced Search in the Metaproteome database, PRIDE, has the option to search on an ENVO term now as well. So you can go to the EBI and click on the PRIDE database and use their advanced search options and get back data based on ENVO terms as well, which is quite nice and quite useful. There are a number of different databases serving up data that you can do this kind of thing using ENVO terms as well now. Just last slide, is slide number 19, just to say again that we've had quite a number of people involved with the development of ENVO to date, and thanks to all of those. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Norman. Our next speaker is Thomas Huang. Thomas?
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me to give my talk today. What I'm about to talk about is some of the work that we've been is still ongoing, and there's still some information I'm still working my way through in terms of releasing it. I'm hoping to have all that cleared out before the AGU next month. But today I'm going to talk about a topic called From Modeling the Earth to Terrain Simulation. Next slide, please. Okay, next slide. So I think the suite is not something new to this community, and is short for for modeling the Earth environment, and it was designed by the late Robert or Rob Baskin, who just passed away early in March. And when he started this work, his intention was try to basically map all the common Earth science keywords like GSMD and FC keywords. And this over the year have turned evolved into a really large collection of ontologies. And and what he has been doing so far is been basically incorporate all other standards that the community has been using. And when he started with just Earth science, and now he already added some of the space science terminology in there. So, and since Dr. Raskin passed away, we acknowledge the fact that there's a huge technology that he has invested, and we would like to carry that on. And at the same time, we also have a project actually already been using this ontology, so which I'm going to be talking about later. Next slide, please. So this is just to give you a little bit of timeline on the evolution of Suite, and I think for those of you who have used Suite, it's quite large. It's, last time I did a check on it, it was over 4,000 concepts. And it's very highly modularized. And we are actually working on the newer version, the 2.4, which I'm planning to, still working on, plan to release sometime early next year. One of the challenges in using Suite 2.3 or 2.2 is the fact that it actually has a lot of imports, and the footprint in terms of design is actually getting overwhelming sometimes. And the question is, how do we make it simpler for people to use this? So, and also as part of that is because of the current project that I'm working on. Next slide. Slide number five. So when we designed the suite, we took the approach is really similar to a reusable framework in terms of software design, where we advocate this as an upper level ontology, where we want to define the common terminology. One of the things that we in our community is that we could be using a lot of terms that could be mean to the same thing or very similar stuff. And the goal is to standardize that. And by creating this top level ontology, then we can derive and extend and build our domain specific ontology. Okay, next slide, please. I get a lot of questions about that. People ask me, send me emails or give me phone calls and ask me about the list of users. Actually, the real answer is I don't have the whole, all the count of how many people are using a suite. The things that we can mine are our web server log and probably find some of the, all the people who, remote IP addresses that pinging our server. But this is the last collection that we know of, is some of it. It's not complete. And if the community here that are using Suite, I think I just saw a presentation earlier that's also referencing to Suite. I would like to know that. I just want to give a collection of who are a user and also be able to better inform our community. The one that I'm working on is the last one at this moment is the AVM or Adaptive Vehicle Make. Next slide, please. So this is actually something that Dr. Raskin has started. It was a proposal he submitted with DARPA sometime last year, and it was funded. It didn't get funded until early this year, shortly after his passing. And DARPA is actually embarking on this idea of revolutionizing the approach in terms of designing and verifying and manufacturing of complex defense systems and vehicles. And what it turns out that in the past it's been very expensive in terms of designing system, vehicles or any kind of system they have there. Is a lot of it is more of a prototyping rather than running through computer simulations. So the AVM is really a portfolio of a collection of programs, and the one that we are working on is what is called the component context and manufacturing model library. And in terms of the program, they call it CAML. And it's really their effort in terms of collecting a set of useful models and map that onto ontologies, and so that they can provide as a way for a designer or as a tool to query and search for the model that they can use in terms of running their simulations. So on the bottom here, there's a website link that you can point to. And really, the system that we're building on is really going to be used by this FANG challenge that's going to be happening later this year. It's open to the public in terms of submitting their design of the next generation of vehicle. And part of that challenge is to be able to use the system that we have developed, where they can actually run through the validations and testing of different combination of terrains. Next slide, please. So the system we're working on is the context modeling. There's two parts of this. There's a component model library, and there's a context model library. And the one we're working on is the context, which is maps the terrain. We have been identified because of the popular use of a suite in terms of defining the Earth environment. And the system we're building is really as a web application and providing a web service RESTful interface. Well, the idea is to provide a knowledge-based linkage between environmental contexts. For example, people would ask for give me a model that allow me to test the that simulates the slope or rocky terrains or gravel or paved texture, and you will basically serve up in terms of either by a set of lookup tables or really providing a library like a dynamic link library that they can download and integrate into their simulation environment. And so it's providing a linkage also to the requirements. So that's a set of requirements that the software has, for AVM has defined, that that is their key in terms of validating the design of this of the vehicle. And the requirement actually has a lot of environmental context in there, and we provide the linkage between the environmental context and to the models that people subscribe submit to. So it's really provided guided discovery, and it's a think of it more like a linking, more like Facebook for environment. And we also provide things like the standard archival service where people can define the model builder can define and submit or update the model descriptions. And so that as they populate the system start printing this linkage internally. And here's the diagram I'm showing that the environmental context they're really looking at is really in terms of aquatic, atmospheric, and land. This is the MTDS vehicle. So it actually goes onto water and also goes to land. And all the environmental things such as the moisture in the air, the temperature, snow, or how deep is the water? If this is actually landing on a beach or something, what's the wave height? That kind of stuff. So, next slide, please. So this is just a top level diagram. Hoping that in the next month's AGU, I can show a little bit more detail of that. What's the system that we're building? And it really is creating an environmental context knowledge system. And it references to a model repository, which is typical to your common archive. And we have model builder who submits the information, provide descriptions and the context. And you have model user who can browse the system and looking for what model that they need to be using. and what requirement they need to satisfy. And really that the information they find is actually going to be deployed or infused onto their simulation environment. Next slide, please. Slide number 10. So sorry for the small font, but I think if you download the slide from the repository here, you can see the a better reading, a bigger font. These are the project defines a set of top-level context that they would like to be used in terms of for describing their models and also in terms of their searching. And we found that there's again, when they came in and talked to Rob, is really they found that there's basically Suite has a complete collection of that. A lot of it is all natural Earth environment descriptions. Of course, when you talk about a terrain and a land surface or environment, there's also a lot of man-made concepts that needs to be added. Or Rob also has some of the man-made stuff in there, but we're actually going to add some more as we design the ontology for this project. So this talks about the relationship, and not really talks about the in terms of how the ontology is linked to it. Is really their decision in terms of looking at, well, for aquatic, this is the breakdown that in terms of top level, how they want to be able to look up for that information. And next slide, please, slide number 11. So we work on the ontology for this project, we leverage a lot of these common ontology from Suite that, again, from the beginning, we promote this as a top-level reuse of the Suite, and we expand some of the concepts, and we also, part of that, too, we also acknowledge that there were some of the missing concepts that should be added back to onto Suite for that could be generalized. So that will be rolled into Suite 2.4. And so I'm just giving you a a diagram shot of one of the view of the ontology that we are working on. As it turned out, DAVA is very fond of ontology work, and they really like to have graphical representations and also as a way to deliver the message and training the user. And not to the point that they, do some complex query, but at least they can know how the information is being laid out for them to search for. So we're looking at this import, expand, and specialize in terms of building this ontology for this project. So next slide, please, slide number 12. So I'm going to be giving more talk about this project next month in HU. Deborah has invited me to give a presentation. I hope by then I have more clarification on what I can share. But I think by this talk here, I give you a sense of the use of a Suite. Historically, we've been using Suite, most of the project using it to describe the Earth and environments and things like that. Whereas now somebody, we actually identify Suite can be used to describe in terms of simulations. It's not so much for building defense work or things like that. It's really for you could use it for to describe environment which could drive the simulations. Next slide, number 13. So there's a website for Suite, which I'm still working on a lot of back end work in terms of try to put more documentation in there. I think the Dr. Raskin have been he's been really busy in terms of trying to maintain all this his own lot of it, personal time. So we try to put a lot of the in the back end. We try to work on giving some more documentation examples. We are actually heavily involved with the ESA Federation, which is chaired by there's a Semantic Web Cluster, which is chaired by Peter Fox, welcome to join that our community, and I do subscribe to that to their email, so that people have questions and about Suite, they usually send to that. There's also a page on that website that talks about the governance of Suite, and you can also send me emails directly if you have any questions about or bug fixes and things like that. So this concludes my talk.
Okay, thank you so much. It was a very interesting talk. Our next speaker is Mark Schildhauer, and he's presenting work that was prepared with his collaborator, Benjamin Adams.
My talk is a bit of a wrap-up. It's a wrap-up that was constructed primarily with Benjamin Adams, who is a new postdoc on a semantics project called Sonnet. He and I worked together to try to think about, what is the situation with earth science ontology, given that we knew we were going to be hearing from several of what we had identified as best of class types of projects. So thank you to all the speakers for representing their various efforts, and I think that we would all agree we heard some really impressive work going on with respect to earth science ontologies. And I also want to thank Ben Adams again for largely putting together this talk. Slide two, please. So I think that what we've seen is that there's really a lot of work going on with respect to earth science terminologies in the form of vocabularies, thesauri, and ontologies. Now, of course, in this case, we've really focused on the ontologies, it's pretty much the most complex constructs compared to some of the flat files and glossaries that we also know are out there. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that there are already indeed a lot of terms that might be nested inside of vocabularies and thesauri that might help inform our ontological and more advanced semantic work as well. So the intent of this session four of the Earth Science Dialogue was to try to concretize where we're at, have some talks from what we believe to be some of the really impressive ongoing efforts, and then consider, well, how should we move forward from here? We're all very keen to facilitate data discovery and interoperability within our own sub-disciplines of the earth sciences, and then we're all probably increasingly recognizing that our disciplines need to connect with one another, and so that we have to really try to achieve interoperability across earth sciences as well. So when the organizers of this group approached the various speakers, we asked them to think about really what was the scope of their current ontology development efforts, what sort of axiomatic structures they were using, and what type of governance was involved in moving that ontology forward. Was it, open? Was it closed? Is there a strong curation, etc.? And I think all of the speakers covered those points quite nicely. Next slide, please. So what you got a glimpse of today was perhaps some of the ontologies you're already aware of. You've probably visited their website, if not downloaded their RDF and OWL files and examined them. And of course, we're all aware that there's a lot more potentially relevant efforts underway out there. And so we've just listed a few more of the prominent examples here. In discussions with Krishna, he said, well, there's this AGI thesaurus, and it's got tens of thousands of useful defined terms for the geological sciences. And perhaps those of you coming from other disciplines could point to your own societal vocabulary building efforts, etc. So there's lots and lots of terms. They're captured in lots of different frameworks. And it's really hard to get a handle on how to really consolidate and affect interoperability among all these various efforts. Although I think opportunities like this Ontolog session and ongoing communication amongst all of us is really a key step towards moving forward. Next slide, please.
Which number is that, Mark?
4.
Thank you.
So even though we laundry listed several of the other prominent vocabulary and thesaurus efforts, for instance, Luis, I think, is still heavily involved with the Marine Metadata Interoperability Group. And if you go to that side or if you go to the OBO Foundry, you can click and see, well, I think that there are about 200 distinct vocabulary / ontologies listed on the Marine Metadata site. And I don't know, Norman, if you know how many there are in the OBO Foundry, but it's at least dozens and dozens. So the irony is that while all of us, I think, are motivated by facilitating much broader and competent data discovery, because we have this babel of earth science data, people collecting information using lots and lots of different phenomena, lots and lots of types of observations, using different methodologies. It's a babel of earth science data out there. And I think, ironically, we're now at risk of creating a babel of metadata and ontologies as well. So I don't think that that's regressive. I think that actually is a step forward. But I think we have to check ourselves and recognize that we don't want to just silo ourselves into more formalized representations that still are only good for usage within our own, beloved communities of interest. Slide 5, please. So with respect to the scope and definitions of terms, when Ben and I were searching around a number of the existing vocabularies, we saw a lot of variability in how the concepts and instances were constructed. And we think that there really needs to be some very strong principles for how we move forward with ontology and vocabulary construction. And I would say that these are so fundamental, we could say they almost should be universal. And for lack of a better word, at this time, we call them enriched concepts. We've also suggested maybe call them nomenclated entities. But basically, whenever you have a concept or a label, you need to provide a definition and an authority for that definition. Now, those of you who have had experience in the biodiversity realm will recognize the similarity of this recommendation to that which taxonomists use relative to differentiating a taxonomic name from a taxonomic concept. And a taxonomic concept is one that is qualified by some sort of a reference to an authority. Usually that would be a publication. And within that publication is some sort of pertinent description about what that term is. And so we have this notion that naked terms should not be permitted. And not to pick on SWEET, but you can find so-called naked terms in SWEET. You can find them in lots of different vocabularies that we reviewed over the past couple of weeks. Every term should, in fact, be defined in a natural language. So we, unlike the biological diversity community, which will often just provide a reference to a name, for instance, they might say that a reference is to Linnaeus. In this case, we feel that there should be an exposed natural language definition associated with the term. But that just a definition alone is not sufficient. That definition has to be backed up by some sort of an authority, which would be a pointer to an unchanging website in the sense that Wikipedia might not be a good choice, because those Wikipedia pages can get revised unless you're providing version information or a pointer to a static authority, such as a publication in the conventional literature or a GWID. And furthermore, we feel there needs to be discussion when you're using these definitions that the authorities you're choosing are appropriate for the scientific community. So there has to be discussion whether pointers to the popular vernacular as opposed to the more constrained and perhaps rigorous scientific vernacular. Slide 6, please. With respect to axiomatic structures, and I think all of us get a little excited when we think about this, we recognize that, well, it's really high time that we move beyond flat files that are simply glossaries. And yet, a lot of different groups are taking different approaches to how many axiomatic structures they exercise in their ontology construction. We heard Louise talk about OTC using RDF and SCOS. Norman, I can't remember if ENVO is in OWL-DL. I think that we heard that SWEET might be an OWL-FULL. And each one of these constructions then has potentially different logical entailments that arise as a consequence of, you know, what level of logical capability they are exercising in their structure. In addition, we feel that several of the speakers brought up this notion of linking to foundational ontologies. And I think Boyan talked about getting inspiration from, in fact, compatibility with Dolce, Norman talking about compatibility with BAFO. We think that this is something that that efforts should consider, whether there is some value in aligning with one. We've listed a couple of what we feel are well-considered foundational ontologies on this slide, whether there are values in facilitating ontological alignment through linkage to some of these upper ontologies. Slide 7, please. So this is really a question more than a statement, you know, whether we should be moving beyond SCOS, certainly beyond flat files and of gloss terms, it might be feasible at this time to consider whether we should be more at the RDFS and OWL level, and specifically because we feel that there is, in fact, some low-hanging semantic fruit if we operate at those levels. And we've listed some of the axiomatic capabilities that we would get, such as disjointness among classes, classes with multiple parents, the ability to specify domain and range constraints on property restrictions, and potentially as well to talk about synonymy in a stricter sense. But I know that that's a much debated issue, you know, relative to using same as or equivalence classes. But you know, in some cases, I think the downside of edge cases need to be factored against the upside of the pragmatic utility in a large number of countervailing cases. Slide 8, please. So, you know, I think what struck Ben and me when we were reviewing a lot of the existing work is that superficially, you always see a lot of really good stuff. In other words, you see terms in there that are juicy and meaningful to you and to the type of data you might want to be describing or discovering. And yet, when you start looking closely, almost without exception, you find certain areas of ontologies that you feel are problematic, if not, you know, just probably, we could say, erroneous in failing to specify obvious relationships or misclassifications. And so we just cut out a couple of pieces from ontologies that we've looked at. As an example, you know, for instance, Hilmar Lapp, who I think is on this call, had pointed out when we were looking at one ontology that he thought it was pretty curious that global climate was considered a subclass of an average. And on the right-hand side, you can see arboreal habitat, which doesn't have any specified relationship with forests, where, of course, arboreal refers to a tree-based habitat. And forests consist of trees. Slide 9, please. With respect to governance issues, I think that this arises from the frustration and the possibilities of having multiple eyes looking at some ontologies and seeing potential uses, potential errors, and wondering then, how can you really commit to using this framework unless you really feel that you're going to trust this group to extend and support this ontology into the future, or that in fact you or your group has an opportunity to participate in revising it or correcting it, that it's not just somebody working, you know, feverishly in their spare time to create this, you know, fundamental set of terms that you're going to be using to annotate your data. So I think that this is still a problem right now, and I saw several questions arising in the chat room during the live discussion asking about issues of governance and licensing on the various ontologies we were hearing about. We're probably all familiar with the concerns about preserving the provenance or ontogeny. We use the term ontogeny. Ontogeny is really more a biological term that pertains to how biological organisms change through a life cycle. So it has less to do simply with pointing to the origins or sources of a term, but recognizing that the term itself could in fact be labile. Potentially many times that lability would be through growing sophistication and nuance in its definition. How is that going to be dealt with as we start annotating to terms and ontologies? And then I'd like to point out as well that when you think about all terms having a natural language definition supported by an authority, we really get some additional capability, because if you have two terms with different labels associated with them, but they do have the same definition in the authority, this perhaps gives us a more potent capability to assert that they might be synonymous. Of course, access to terms is a big issue. And, for instance, in the case of the AGI thesaurus, which I think has, you know, 30,000 some odd well-glossed base terms, but the rights to use on that are, you know, problematic, in a broad usage scenario where you'd want people to be able to annotate to those terms and have anybody be able to, explore those sets of terms. Because it's both a copyrighted and licensed resource. Slide 10, please. Understandably, all of us construct our ontologies and our metadata language with some specific community in mind. Ironically, I think in this day of broad concerns about integration in the earth sciences, what we're actually doing is creating what I call a next generation silo. Earth and environmental sciences really increasingly span multiple domains, and so the need to be able to integrate these representations across subdomains and across ontologies is extremely important. Slide 11, please. So I think I've already talked about the need for interoperability and not only sustainability but participation in developing and creating the ontologies. But I'd like to point out that right now I think we've got a really great opportunity to move forward with this. And again, this ontolog discussion itself represents the type of communication that I think is absolutely necessary. You've seen the National Science Foundation scoping a huge cyber infrastructural effort in its EarthCube program. We heard mention of ESIP, MMI. There's a large data net called Data One that's very concerned with semantics, and Deborah McGinnis, I think, is participating in this call. She's the leader of that group. We heard from OGC, and then there are a number of other representatives and colleagues. Most of you are involved with one or more of these, and what I got, these are all largely academic efforts. There's some agency involvement, but I think that there's a lot of additional industry and agency efforts that could also provide useful input. So that's the conclusion, that I think that we really have a signal opportunity to collaborate, if not coordinate, on developing these earth science ontologies and avoid establishing a new battle of terms. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. And now we'll we have time for discussion, if anyone would like to express their thoughts.
Again, for those who are not already on the chat in the chat room, please sign into the chat room. The link is at the top of the session page there. For those who are already in the chat room, please click on the hand button if you have some comments to make or a question to ask the panelists or even other participants in the session. So maybe we'll wait a moment or two for...
Peter, this is Mark. I've got a question that I wanted to ask of several of the speakers. We heard Boyan talk about developing a representation of voids in terms of definitions of gaps and holes. And then Norman said, you know what, and I think there was a little discussion about this in the chat area as well, it appears that Enbo's conceptualization of gaps and holes was quite similar. And I imagine that conceptualization borrows heavily from the anatomical ontology, where clearly, you know, you think about yourself and there's lots of gaps and holes in all of us. So I was just wondering, you know, if this is an example for me of where we're dealing with very similar concepts. We're delighted when there seems to be kind of convergence, and yet isn't there really an opportunity for getting broad agreement? So I don't know if Boyan or Norman could respond to that.
Okay, it's Boyan. Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I agree. There's convergence, it seems, around the notion of containment, and that would be worthwhile to explore. I think that's a good idea. I think it's basic to a lot of the things that some of us are doing. So that would definitely be worthwhile. I would only comment that, in terms of the formal mechanics, there hadn't been much before on gaps, although there was on holes. So we filled a gap with gaps there a little bit. but it would be good to see how that is carried over in other areas that we may not have seen.
Did you examine the anatomical ontologies to get any inspiration?
We looked at the formal theories behind them that talked about voids and containment.
Doug Foxbog, do you have a question?
Yes. I was wondering what work has been done already on doing mappings between the various earth science ontologies, if any. Did you hear me?
Yeah, we heard you. I think we're thinking. Anybody like to answer that?
There's been it's Boyan again. I know we've done a little bit of work looking at, for instance, how SWEET would map in with some of the prominent schemas out there like GeoSciML for various purposes. But overall, I think it's not a well-developed area, probably.
Thank you.
Scott Hills?
Okay, good. So a question about, and this is a little bit of a diversion, I suppose, from actual construction of the ontologies to a question about consuming them. Mark has on his slide 11 a bullet that lists a bunch of initiatives that are involved in developing earth science ontologies. Several of them I recognize as also being involved in efforts to define metadata content standards, which are, and several of them in particular are based on ISO 19115. There's an, and all of those have an opportunity then to sort of leverage common ontologies for describing the content which are documented by those metadata standards or metadata records that adhere to those standards. I guess my question is there any thought or efforts, if it's gone beyond thought, to establishing a common interface by which these distributed collections and distributed applications that might be interested in them could consume online ontologies? Is there any standards in this space that, and I guess the only one that I saw mentioned in the talk, I don't remember who mentioned it, but it was the SysVoc interface. But that would seem a necessary part. I mean, the ontology is the, you might say, is the fuel, but accessing it, I think, is often separate from, or is as distributed, the consumers are as distributed in wanting to access ontologies as the ontologies are, and the metadata records in this case are themselves. Is that, was that as clear as mud?
I think that's a well-recognized problem, especially in the NCBI, NCBO ontology group. Norman, could you tell us a bit about how you guys, within your broad bioinformatics community, are sharing terms from the various ontologies you're constructing there?
Yeah, sure. So I was just going to can you hear me, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah. So ENVO was developed under the umbrella of the OBO Foundry, which is the ontology for biomedical and biological open biomedical and biological ontologies foundry, the principles of which are documented well online, but basically the overriding one was that they were to develop a set of orthologous ontologies that would be complementary to one another, that would have some kind of overriding governance model, and that would try to encourage people, were they to be sort of working in somebody else's domain, encourage them to participate and work more with somebody else who might have developed a body of work in that area already. So this was to avoid this sort of as you described, Mark, as this proliferation of ontologies and a babble that nobody could ever work with. And designed to support that is quite a lot of infrastructure as well. So you can find much of the ENVO, along with all its other siblings, listed on BioPortal, which I think answered the other question that just came up just earlier a little bit, that there are mechanisms available for being able to serve up these ontologies, points of focus, where I think it's important to be able to go along and say, you know, what ontologies are there available for me to consume as a user.
Norman, did you have a question as well?
I was going to follow up a little bit on the discussion of health. I think we've moved on from that a little bit now, so I'll retract my hand.
Boyan or Peter, do you have something to say?
Yes, I do. Peter here. This also partly answers Scott's question as well as extends to Norman's remarks. As I posted to the chat room, there has been an ongoing effort called the Open Ontology Repository. It's not specifically catered to earth sciences as such, but more an ontology effort by the ontology community encompassing maybe different domains. But the crux of it is an infrastructure project, is a computer science and research project, and it's also a content project. The link is oor.net. We have quite a few of the ontology repositories on board that network, some of which are of particular interest to this group, like the MMI, ORR, the SOCOP, OR, Oak Ridge, DAC, BioPortal, and Torsten just mentioned some of the work that he and Boyan have been developing will be hosted in Kalori, which is also a part of that network as well. So it's getting some momentum, and we welcome everyone who is running ontology repositories to come join us, and we can jointly as a community develop the strategies whereby we could tackle this Tower of Babel problem. Among the participants there, there's one group running an effort called the Onto Hub, and Onto Hub is backed by the technologies that are going into this developing ISO standard called OntoIOP. It's for ontology integration and interoperability. And instead of hosting ontologies in certain languages, their specific purpose is to map between ontologies of different languages. So besides mapping similar terms among different ontologies, with the OntoHub effort, people could look forward to mapping across different languages.
So this is Scott again. If I can ask a follow-up question, Peter?
Sure.
Just for clarification, is the Open Ontology Repository then looking to identify a standard web service API for applications to consume ontologies, regardless of whatever the dialect or the form in which they've been archived or stored, managed?
That's part of the mission, but I can defer to a couple of people who are also among us here. Ken Bukowski, who actually leads the architecture and API effort, and Michael Gruninger, who leads our metadata and standards effort. So maybe either one or both of them could also chime in.
Okay, or I can follow up if this is of narrow interest. So,
Joel Fax, are you waiting for, are you next in line?
I was wondering, I guess, of everybody that presented, the extent to which they see their efforts as helping people find data that could be useful to them versus computing with the data. So are the tools that are being developed being used to label data sets or to, for example, label columns or to mark up data and represent data itself?
Joel, I didn't catch the question part of it.
You know, some of the work that was described, I guess, could roughly be called metadata standards, and some actually has to do with definitions of data items themselves, like how to interpret the geographic coordinates, for example, or a particular datum that those coordinates are expressed with reference to. And others, to describe, for example, it seems most of the terms in the environment ontology would be the associated metadata with a sample or a specimen. And I guess in terms of whether two terms are similar or exact matches, if you're using the terms as metadata, presumably, there's more latitude to have an inexact match because you're searching. You can always filter out the data that doesn't quite match your needs. As if you get the if you remember in a Adwood conversation, we were once told of a terrible story where a pilot died because datum of the geo coordinates that he was using weren't the ones that were that he assumed they were.
Okay, well, we seem to have run out of time. I'd like to close this fourth session of the Earth Science Ontolog miniseries presentations. I'd like to acknowledge the contributions of Dr. Yim and Antalog for hosting this session to NSF EarthCube for lending their sponsorship, and to all members of the planning committee, as well as everyone who paid it. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your thoughts, and we hope you will participate in the next session, the topic of which will be tutorials, the science ontology tutorials. Thank you and goodbye.